Louis Cyr is the strongest man I've never heard of before this last week. He was born in Canada in 1863, and he was a strength prodigy as a child. At age 18, he won his first strongman contest, lifting a horse on a platform with iron bars attached. The horse, not counting the platform, weighed over 1,500 pounds. And his greatest feat was when he once lifted a platform on his back. He did a back lift with 18 grown men on it. The estimate was it was about 4,300 pounds. He had a lot of other incredible strength feats. You want to look him up. Some of them are probably urban legend, but there's a documented 534-pound one lift, one finger lift. Pretty impressive. So the modern Guinness record for pinky lift, guess what it is? 220 pounds. That's the record for pinky lift. So his health began to fail at age 41 from inactivity. He was tired by then. And also from overeating. He would eat 6 pounds of meat at one meal. That would do it to you. He died at age 49. William James Sidis is the smartest guy I'd never heard of. He was born in Boston in 1898. His estimated IQ was 220 to 270. The point of reference, Einstein, was around 170. At age 6, he could speak English, Latin, French, German, Russian, Hebrew, Turkish, and Armenian. And I thought, why? And then he could read the New York Times before he was 2. Now imagine being his super church teacher. He entered Harvard at age 11. He got accepted at age 9, but he needed to mature a bit, so he started at age 11. He became a professor, and then he went off the grid, if there was a grid in the early 20th century. But he hated all of it. He became a household name and hated every bit of it. His friends who knew him at the end of his life said he became happy when he was out of the line life. He worked manual jobs. He was an office clerk. Now, again, imagine being the office manager and him being your office clerk and not knowing. He wrote books. We don't even know how many because he wrote them, most of them under assumed names, pseudonyms. He didn't want the publicity. He died at age 46 of a brain hemorrhage. So, okay, we've got the strongest, the smartest. What else? You have the richest, the most beautiful. These titles are never held very long by people. And when was the last time you thought of these two guys? You say, never. Exactly. They died in 1912 and 1944, and so when was the last time really anyone thought of them? They were physically and mentally limited humans, just slightly less so than other limited humans. And they could, for a nanosecond in cosmic history, boast of being the strongest or the smartest. So I was thinking this week, maybe instead of classes and schools for the gifted, they should be schools for the slightly less limited. It might inspire more humility, and it's more in line with reality. Because for all humans, there's only one legitimate boast. There's actually two, but they're similar. And I'll give you one now and a second in a few minutes. The first comes from Jeremiah 9. Let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, or the strong man boast of his strength, or the rich man boast of his riches. But let him who boasts boast about this, that he understands and knows me. So the first legitimate boast is not wisdom, not strength, not riches, but to know the Lord. And we know him because he's made himself known. This boast is really a boast of his grace to us. So today we're in 2 Corinthians 12. We're coming up next week. We're winding up our time in Paul's letters to the Corinthians. We started there at the beginning of the year. And Paul's continuing to use what he calls fool's talk in order to make an important point. Paul first boasted about his Jewish pedigree because some of the divisive teachers that invaded Corinth were Jewish background believers who claimed to be the real deal and said Paul wasn't. Then he boasted about his trials as a church planter, Christ follower, to demonstrate that his commitment to Christ showed up in what he actually did with his life. But all this, he said in his own words, is folly. They had forced his hand in that the Corinthians had become impressed with these super Christians with cool persona, cool resumes, and they'd been led astray by that coolness into beliefs and behaviors that were wrong. And so Paul's doing two things at the same time. He's demonstrating very clearly that if you're going to compare stats, his stats are better than these super-duper apostles. And then second, this whole thing of boasting is foolish. Their value system needs to be aligned with the mind of Christ. And so after giving his Jewish stats and the evidence of his commitment to Christ, he's going to really give the Corinthians what they would have found to be impressive. And that is a cool supernatural experience that put him clearly ahead of the super apostles. In fact, it was an experience that would connect him with the Old Testament patriarchs and prophets. It was one of several experiences Paul had where he'd received visions and revelations in his life, but this was sort of the coolest of the cool. So look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 1. I must go on boasting, although there's nothing to be gained. I'll go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. So he's working his way through his stat sheet, not to be impressive, but to show how ridiculous it is. He said he gets the visions and revelations from the Lord, and visions and revelations are not two different events per se, but refer to a supernatural experience where you gain new insight. Like Peter had a vision of the sheet filled with unclean animals, where as a result of the vision, he gains revelation or insight into the fact that God accepts non-Jews as his people. So Paul's going to talk in the third person, which can sound a little weird, but it's either because this was just such a sacred experience for him, or it could have been to make a distinction between the Paul, quotation marks, who had the cool vision, and the Paul who's telling the lesson to be learned. So it's probably just a linguistic device to help see that the real lesson here is not what they or maybe we would think it is. Verse 2, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether it was in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. And I know that this man, whether in body or apart from the body, I don't know, but God knows. I think he wants us to get that point. He doesn't know, but God does. Was caught up to paradise, and he heard inexpressible things, things that a man is not permitted to tell. This happened just a few years after Paul had become a Christian. He was probably in his early 40s. And he's using terminology that his hearers would have made sense out of, like heaven, third heaven, paradise. But don't try to over-scrutinize this or think Paul's giving some layered physical cosmology. He isn't. He doesn't even understand the experience. In fact, he doesn't know if the mechanism that God used was to transport him physically to another realm or if his body stayed in this realm and his spirit traveled to another. He doesn't know. It's interesting to me, I've mentioned this before, Trish, we've talked about this, how often the multiverse shows up in everywhere, every movie. Never heard of it 5 years ago, now it's in every movie. It's a very convenient plot line because you can kill off a hero and bring in their alternate universe double. You can also jump around and do whatever you want because in the multiverse, anything that could happen does happen. But the multiverse is Marvel comic fact. It's theory and pure in the real world. But Paul's not speculating on the science of the experience, even though it's clearly not anti-scientific, or on the physical makeup of the cosmos, although it happened in the real cosmos. He has a purpose for telling this. He's showing them that he has Jewish pedigree, he suffered for the gospel, he has supernatural experiences that are impressive, but he's going to turn it all on its head because he's not making any of this the reason for his actual boasting. And Paul only mentions this really cool experience once in all of his letters here, and he gives it four sentences. And we would write books, sign a movie contract, go on speaking tours, make a living from an experience like this. Paul talks about it one time. He doesn't talk about what he saw. He only barely mentions what he heard because he said these things are classified top secret. They were for Paul to hear, not for Paul to tell. And so now Paul has the ultimate path to outflank his opponents. This would be his ultimate mic drop moment. Boom, super apostles compete with that. But he goes in a very different direction than the youngsters at Corinth would expect. He doesn't give all the details of the experience. In fact, he's done talking about it, except as a background for his true boast. Look at verse 5. I'll boast about a man like that, but I'll not boast about myself except about my weakness. Even if I would choose to boast, I would not be a fool because I'd be speaking the truth. So I could boast about this. It happened. But I refrain so no one will think more of me than is warranted by what I do or say. So he's separating himself grammatically from the person who had the amazing experience. He said, yeah, that guy's impressive. Of course, that guy's him, but me, I'm weak. Again, it's his verbal device to make his point. Don't focus on the amazing experience. That's not the main thing. The main thing is the painful outcome of the amazing experience and the profound outcome of that experience. So verse 7, to keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, it was given to me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. So instead of making much of his spiritual experience, as his opponents were doing of theirs, he explains how he was kept from being overinflated by it. Now remember, if you've been here this year when we were in 1 Corinthians, the church at Corinth was very prone to chase and to be impressed by supernatural experiences. And so Paul addressed that. He had to set their values straight in this regard. So all of 1 Corinthians 12 speak to the use and the pursuit of supernatural gifts, followed by the majestic chapter 13. So he gives all this, the gifts and the use of gifts, Then he says, now I'll show you the most excellent way. Then he goes into outlining the priority of love, not experience, not showy gifts. So think of our heart values like crooked teeth. And crooked teeth and our values are fixed by braces, truth braces. And those braces need to be continually adjusted and tightened. And it can hurt, but it's necessary. And these truth braces, I hate to tell you, are going to have to stay on for the rest of our lives. Our teeth are prone to wander. And our perspectives wander, so we need these braces on. But it's much less painful to let the truth adjust us day by day, a bit at a time. And so here, Paul's having to, in his letters, really crank down, because these Corinthians, I hate to tell you, but their teeth had really gotten out of alignment, their priorities. And so there's lots of speculation as to what this thorn was for Paul. We don't know. So evidently, it's not important for us to know. There are a lot of things we'd like to know, but God has not seen fit to tell us. And there are two directions we can go with that fact. One is when, and I've seen this, when someone really is bothered by the fact that God hasn't chosen to make clear what they want him to make clear, then they begin to distrust him because he won't tell them what they want him to tell them. The other route is to trust God that he's good and smart enough to tell us what we need to know. And that's an important fork in the road. We're all going to come to a place where I really want to know this and you're not going to know because God didn't deem fit to tell you, and you can distrust him or you can distrust him. And that leads to two very dramatically different life paths. But here, I think the details of Paul's thorn are left intentionally vague so we can relate any number of scenarios to the principle. Was it physical? Was it spiritual? Was it attack from people? Was it a combination of all the above? We don't know, probably so that we can all apply our situation to the principle. Satan is said to be behind the thorn. Satan is a dog on a leash. And God holds the leash. And God, for his own good purposes in Paul's life, lets Satan nip at Paul. He limits Satan. He won't let him sink his teeth in too deep. But Paul, like any sane person, does not enjoy being nipped at by a vicious dog, so he asks God to rein the dog in. It's interesting to me that Paul knows exactly how many times he asked God. Three. Not four, not two, but three. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. So I don't know if Paul asked and God said, no, my power is perfect in weakness. He asked, same. Or if he asked and God just answered and Paul kept asking. I don't know. But it does illustrate an important point and a super difficult point in regards to our relationship with God. And it's a principle that can be stated with two simple phrases, but it's not really simple to live out. And the simple phrases are, ask your Father for what you want. Trust your Father for what he gives. A couple weeks ago, I was sitting with a friend in his office who had asked God for one thing about a year ago. And this ask was that God would allow him some more time before a particular hardship would come. The hardship was looming on the horizon. And he said, God, I just one thing. Can you hold that off until 2 years from now? Because he thought it would be better, allow him to better serve the people he was leading. This guy has a really good heart. I've known him for years. I admire him a lot. And God said no. The one thing he feared happened, and it happened at the worst possible time from his perspective. He wasn't bitter. He was just, hey, Terry, tell me what to think about this. And so now he had to continue to lead, even though he could not have imagined how he could do so. So my friend's ask was reasonable. He didn't think that he had personally what it takes to lead a large and complex organization and deal with this particular hardship in addition to the other hardships. And God, of course, didn't go, psh, whatever. He wasn't offended by the ask, but it turns out that God is more interested in my friend learning what it means to thrive in weakness than to lead in his own strength. And that's what Paul wanted, what God wanted for Paul. And so Paul somehow made this mental transition. He stopped asking God to remove the cause of the weakness and instead moved to embracing Christ's strength in his own weakness. And the verb tenses Paul uses in this, in his phrasing go like this. God said to me, and the verb tense is past action with ongoing results. So the Lord had spoken to him and said, I've spoken. This is the way it's going to be. Now press on. My grace is sufficient. And the verb tense is present active, meaning the grace is going to be continually available to Paul. So the way Paul chose to word this is God said, the struggle is going to be ongoing. My grace is going to be sufficiently ongoing as well. So the question I had when I read this is, when do we stop asking God to do something different or change circumstances or just accept what he's given. Because you have this, for Paul asked, Paul knocked three times, God said no, and he said okay. You have Jesus telling the parable of the persistent widow who just wore that judge down, wore him out till he gave in. And Jesus said, keep asking. And so how do you know when you just keep asking or when you stop? I have no idea. So there are too many different scenarios to give an answer to that question. God evidently spoke to Paul. Jesus said, keep knocking. We don't know. But I do know this, that the way we bring our ask to the Father is crucial to what direction our lives go, regardless of how he answers. So it's important to ask and not demand. Big difference. It's important to trust and not presume. It's important to, in our asking, be learning to love him, not just want him for what he does or doesn't do. And that's what seems to come from Paul's heart. Therefore, I'll boast all the more gladly about my weakness so that Christ's power may rest on me. That's why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, in insult, in hardship, in persecution, in difficulty. For when I am weak, then I'm strong. And there's our second legitimate boast, boasting about weakness. So we can boast in the Lord, we can boast about our weakness. Now, what are we to do with this? Here's some options for your consideration. We can determine that, well, here's what I think is going on. Paul is superhuman. These are challenging words from Superman, but clearly beyond me. Or you can say, Paul's crazy. He's nuts to delight in this stuff. There's something wrong with him. Or Paul is just exaggerating. He's using hyperbole. He didn't really think this is true or real. It's a figure of speech. And I don't think those are valid options. Paul doesn't ever present himself as anything other than human. He's very slow to tell the amazing stuff and quick to admit to his own struggles. Paul doesn't enjoy weakness as such. Nobody does. He doesn't love struggle. He doesn't love pain. He doesn't love persecution. He does love the outcome. So he's not crazy. And Paul's not using intentional exaggeration here. He's not saying that he feels this way every single minute of every day. He's not saying that this perspective doesn't take ongoing choice. He's not saying that it's not hard for him, volitional for him, to stay here. So here's a line of thinking I employed as I considered this passage, and I'll give it to you. Maybe you can apply it to yourself. I thought, first, I'm like Paul in that we're both just human. And it's not helpful for me to approach the human characters in the Bible as being dramatically different than I am in terms of their potential. Because when I say, oh, well, Paul, that's Daniel, that's Peter, well, then it takes a necessary challenge off of me to push me towards change. They're not that different in potential than I am, either the potential for depth of maturity or the ability to mess things up. So I like to look at the Bible thinking I can be just like the best or the worst character in the Bible. Second, though I'm like Paul in some ways, Paul is unlike me in his spiritual maturity. He's just beyond me. And I told Christy, my wife, this week, I'm somewhere between Paul and the Corinthians. I'm not the Corinthians. I'm 62. I'm not impressed with super apostles. I think it's dumb. But I also don't readily embrace weakness. So I'm somewhere in between. I told her, in fact, I detest weakness. I detest it in myself. I detest it in others. So that's a terrible admission. Yeah, but it's just true. You say, well, you are weak. I know. That's what makes it so dumb, but I still detest weakness. I have the same potential for maturity that Paul does, every Christian does, but Paul made consistently more and better choices than I have so far, and so those choices matured his values in a way that put him beyond me. That doesn't depress me. That encourages me. He's like me. He's unlike me. He's unlike me, not because he's Superman, but because he's made choices that I can make. He's a work in progress. He was a work in progress. He's completed now. But like you and me, he was a work in progress. He was just further down the road. So I can grow in my maturity in this if I'm willing to make the necessary choices to do so. It's a fact that as humans, we're weak. It's also a fact that we can learn to see Christ's strength revealed in us. So let's land in verses 9 and 10 and walk around there for just a minute. Therefore, I'll boast all the more gladly about my weakness so that Christ's power may rest on me. That's why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weakness, insult, hardship, persecution, difficulty, for when I'm weak, then I'm strong. And again, I said that Paul never mentioned this amazing experience before or after this. He doesn't use this incredible experience to give himself credibility or indicate that this makes him special. Listening to a podcast this weekend about a pastor who had a rather spectacular fall, and his friend said he would go back to an experience in his past that made him look strong over and over and over and over and over in his life. And Paul was the opposite of that. He uses this incredible experience to show his own weakness. He had to have this constant reminder in order to not be proud about something he had nothing to do with. And so instead of going back to this experience over and over to validate his message, his ministry, his life, he goes to his own difficulties, his own weakness. He doesn't preach, okay, now look, you guys go have an amazing experience like this. I mean, I've had the road to Damascus, I've had this, I've had lots of experiences. You guys need to go get you some. It'll validate your life and make you special. Instead, he focuses on the truth of the gospel and the reality of God's strength revealed in weakness. And guess what? Those two things are available to anyone. God decides who gets this experience, that experience. We can decide, am I going to embrace the truth? Am I going to embrace weakness? So in Corinth, the opposite was trying to take root. There was a perverted gospel that obscured God's truth trying to take root. There was a glorification of human greatness that threatened to obscure God's glory. So here's application. Paul's not Superman. You and I, we can embrace, not hide or run from our own weakness. And in so doing, we can live in the Lord's grace and power. And then there are choices, there are pathways, there are disciplines that help us become this kind of person. It's not just sitting around hoping it happens to us someday. So I've used this Groopman's book, The Anatomy of Hope, many times over the years. I'll bring out his model again. But Groopman is an oncologist who discovered that hope has an anatomy like the body has an anatomy. And he found that people who had hope had three things. They had belief, expectation, and desire. And people who lost hope was missing one of those three things. And so let's use those three terms, ideas, and let's do some self-examination. I don't want this to be spiritual, churchy, yeah, that's great, God is strong, we're weak, blah, 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 go live our lives. I want to, if it's not practical, if it doesn't make it out there, I'm not interested in it. And so let's personalize this. So here's our analogy. I'm dying of thirst in the desert. We're dying of thirst in the desert. We need hope. If you don't have hope, you die. And so we need hope based on reality, though, not based on unreality. So you need three things, according to Groopman, to keep going. You need to believe that there's water out there. If you think there ain't no water in this desert, you're not going to keep going. You need expectancy, that you have agency. Agency just means you have the ability, if you want to get the water that's there. And then desire is not emotion, but action. What kind of choices will I make to go get the water? So move into your own inner space right now. Think about this personally. Examine yourself in these three things. So belief, what do you actually factually believe is true? If you don't think something is true, then clearly you're not going to take steps that direction. You may show up for church or show up for group, but you're not going to actually take hard steps that way if you don't really think it's true. So do you believe this is a good direction to go? This whole idea of embracing weakness to reveal his strength. Do I believe God's power is made perfect, revealed in my weakness? Do I believe God's grace is going to be sufficient for me if I stop trying to control my life? Do I believe God and his ways are good and best? Why or why not? And what could I do to firm up my beliefs? What practical things could I do to help me grow in believing that it's better to embrace weakness than run from it, hide from it, deny it, despise it? And listen, I'm not saying embrace weakness as an excuse for sin or passivity. The opposite of what I mean. I mean as the reality of my life. Expectancy. So belief is the cognitive. Do I actually think something's true? Expectancy is personalizing the truth. Do I believe I have agency? Can I make a choice that makes a difference? If I don't think it's true, I won't move that way. If I don't think my choices matter, I have an addiction. And this addiction is completely based on my genetics. It's not changing. Like our granddaughter Nora, she has a trait because she has a genetic flaw. It's in her DNA. She can't choose out of that. So whatever it is you would like to see change, do you believe that it's built into who you are? You can't change, which means you don't have agency. Back to our example, if you're dying of thirst, you can believe there's a stream. You hear it trickling. You go, that's not just an illusion of thirst, but I'm chained to a post. I'm not getting to the stream. so I'm not going to struggle anymore. Do you have the expectation that you can make choices that actually impact your spiritual maturity and growth? Has God given agency to you? Do I expect that my choices, as much as anyone else's, can have impact? Can I change? Can I grow? And how I treat my spouse, and how I walk with Jesus, and how I move through life, magnifying his strengths, and not hiding from or despising or pretending about my weakness? Am I chained in a change of no expectation of agency? You know what, Terry, my choices aren't going to change anything. They haven't so far. Or is God saying, I give you choice, choose. And then desire. Desire is where we take actual actions, where the process moves from the mind to the feet. I believe the stream trickling over there is real. It can save my life, quench my thirst. Expectancy, I'm not chained up here. I'm tired, I'm hot, got blisters, but I'm not chained up here. Desire, I'm going to get up. I'm going to walk across the hot sand. I'm going to drink the water. So specifically here, what plans will I make and what people will I get to help me? So that's pretty simple. It is. It's pretty simple, but it's just hard to sustain. So what do these plans look like? Plans look like, what are you talking about in terms of doing? Is there some kind of a secret here I haven't heard of? No. Don't throw something at me, but the plans are read your Bible, pray, live in community, ask for forgiveness. See, I already do all that stuff. We'll keep doing it. That is the plan. It's like someone who said, you know, going to play in the NFL, and they're going to go from, they're a middle school player, then they're a high school player, then they're a college player, and they're going to play in the NFL, and they go, okay, now, I know what it takes to play high school, college. You know, you got to tackle, run, throw. You got to block. Okay, but now I'm going to the NFL. What's it take to get there? Tackle, run, block, throw. It's still a football shaped the same. And so the process to get there are things that we lean into. Maybe you got to lean into them differently. Maybe you say, well, I read the Bible. Maybe you got to read the Bible differently. Maybe you need to perk up. Read it for change. Read it as if it's real. Read it as if this applies to me. Maybe in terms of expectancy, you say, you know, I think I can change. Maybe you don't. Maybe you need to examine and say, maybe you think there is some kind of change tying you to a pillar that someone else doesn't have. That person can do it because they're not me. They don't have this. Do you believe God's given you agency or not? So, do you want to see, let's ask this. I'm going to ask it for all of us. I've been asking myself this question this week. Talked to Christy about it some. Do you want to see God reveal his strength in your life, knowing it's going to be revealed in weakness? So be honest, do you? And here's one answer that you might come up with. No, not really. And that's an honest answer. And that's good. But consider this, you're not going to save your life. In the end, all of us, we're going to spend our life or waste our life, but there's not option three. Save it. No one gets out of life alive. And all humans are weak. When it comes down to it, a lot of our sense of control is mostly illusion. We do have, God's given us, choice over who we become. But other than that, controlling outcomes is a lot of illusion. You say, okay, I get that, but I still don't know, or I just don't want to give in to God, at least not now. I want to keep trying to do things my way. I'm afraid of what might happen if I surrender. I'm afraid of what he might do. I'm afraid of what I might lose. That's okay. I'm not selling anything here. You know, in the Bible, you tell the gospel. You don't sell the gospel. You have to choose. And God is no bully. He doesn't kick down the doors of people's hearts. He knocks, but we have to open. But I would tell you, just consider the implications of continuing to live your life your own way. Think through all the way to the conclusion. What we do when we're building scenarios is we stop at imaginary good places. Some people catastrophize and they take everything to a bad conclusion, but some people stop at an imaginary good place. If I do this my own way, if I give in to my own feelings, emotions, addictions, whatever, it's going to feel like this. Okay, now don't stop there. Take it all the way to its logical end. What's the logical conclusion to your current trajectory? Don't stop at a happy imaginary place short of the end. Another answer, and this would be my answer, is do you want to really embrace this, live this way? And I would say, yeah, sort of, sometimes, maybe, I wish. Because I'm somewhere between a deciding Corinthian and a decided Paul. And I don't mean deciding on the gospel being true. I settled that a long time ago. I'm talking about Do I really want to fully lean into embracing weakness to experience Christ's strength? So what needs to happen next if you're kind of like me? You're sort of a sometimes, maybe, wish. I had years ago I was at a conference and my mentor was speaking and the singer was singing this song, really cheesy song that thank goodness we don't use anymore. But it's like, and he would sing, you know, "Oh, Christy, do you love Jesus?" And she's supposed to go, "Yes, I love Jesus." And, "No, Christy, why do you love Jesus?" "Because he first loved me." And he would do that, and it was really a painful thing to watch. But he did it in his conference. It was great with super church, but wasn't that great with grown-ups. And he got to my friend, my mentor, and I said, "Oh, don't try it on him." And he said, "Oh, Harold, do you love Jesus?" And my friend Harold said, "Yeah, Bill, sometimes I do." And Bill was like, okay, do you really love Jesus?" He goes, "Yeah, Bill, sometimes I really love Jesus." And it was so honest, you know, because this is a guy who's committed to Jesus, a track record of walking with Jesus, but the truth is he's a work in progress. And so what needs to happen next? Sanctification in the Bible, justification is an event in time. Christ comes into my life, I'm born again. Sanctification is a process where he's making me like Christ. And our perspective or our heart value teeth always need braces. They need continual adjustment. And so if you're in that place where you're like, "No, I don't think so. I don't really want to be there right now, I don't think." Well, then that's honest. Take that honesty to God, but consider the outcome of that choice. If you're sort of in between Paul and the Corinthians, then can you say for now, this morning, "Jesus, I want to be all yours. I want your strength revealed in my weakness. Help me. Help me." That's a legitimate prayer. So we're going to spend some time considering all that personally. And we haven't verbalized prayers for you this morning because we want to give you time to verbalize your own prayer. Talk to God. So I'm going to hand off to Rodney, and we're going to use some music and some reflection time for you to think about these things that we've talked about.